Good morning and thank you for coming to session number 104, The Real Archives 2.0. I'm Kate Timer and I'll be your chair. And let me introduce our speakers, who are, in the order of appearance, Angela McClendon Osser is the University Archivist at the University of Texas at San Antonio. She received her MSLS from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 2007. Jessica Sedgwick is the Archivist for Women in Medicine at the Countway Library of Medicine at Harvard University. She received her MLS from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 2008. Mary Sebwelian is an archivist at the Electronic Records Unit at the North Carolina State Archives, where she's currently working on the GeoMap project. If you want to know what that is, you can ask her about it afterwards. Mary earned her MLS in May 2008 from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill after ending a successful 10-year career in human resources. She was the recipient of the SAA's 2008 Theodore Calvin Pease Award for Superior Writing Achievement by a student of archival administration. You may have noticed that all of our speakers are from the same program. All of the research that they're going to be talking about was conducted for their master's thesis under the supervision of Cal Lee, and it was Cal who organized this session, and I'm very grateful to him for doing that and for including me as chair. Okay, I'm going to give you, obviously, a brief introduction to what we mean by Archives 2.0. First of all, what it is not. It's not a passing fad. It's not just Archives plus Web 2.0, which is the most common thing that a lot of people think it is. And it's not something that's in the future. It's here right now. It's all around us. You are going to sessions all day long about Archives 2.0, and you don't even know it. And it's also not just for tech people. And one of the reasons that we're having me do this introduction is because the way that our speakers are going to be talking about Archives 2.0 is much broader than just a technology thing. And I'm not going to read all these bullet points. And all the slides will be posted online on the SAA site, and I'll put mine on SlideShare, and probably they will too. In addition, this session is being a video podcast, prepared for video podcast. I'm not sure where it's going to be podcast, but the audio and the video will be online sometime soon. So when we talk about Archives 1.0 versus 2.0, and again, these are huge generalizations, but it's just to give you sort of a ballpark idea. It's about more than technology. It's also about practice. So the main things about 2.0 are open, transparent, user-centered, all those good things that we love, or I hope all of us love. And that Archives 2.0 is a natural evolution. This isn't a radical revolutionary change. The archival profession in the United States is maturing. We're having increased professionalization. There's the evolution of the technology, of course. Everything that Web 2.0 is making possible is adding to the changes that are already underway in the profession. We have more sophisticated users, and we have a more diverse group of users. So those are also impacting the way we do our work. So that's the framework for what our speakers are going to be talking about when they talk about Archives 2.0. So I'll turn it over to them.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. I hear more chairs are on the way. This presentation is based on research I conducted for my master's paper at UNC in the summer of 2007. This presentation and the study should be considered more of an Archives 2.0 topic than a Web 2.0 topic, although I will consider the findings of the study in the context of Web 2.0, meaning how can we take these findings and use them to create our brave new sort of Archives 2.0 world. Kay talked about what's meant by the term Archives 2.0 in her intro. This study will focus on the four particular aspects of Archives 2.0 that my research really touches on. First is transparency, particularly being transparent to our users. Second, keeping the user in mind, letting our users' needs shape the way we develop things, being open to new ways of doing things, and showing a willingness to take risks. And I'll touch more on these ideas later. So this is what I set out to answer. How much information about us and about our decision-making and appraisal and processing do our researchers really want? Do they want to know our names, our titles, our past processing experience, the type and extent of our education? What about our genders or our political affiliations? And do they want to know what I've done to a collection when I've processed it, how I've rearranged it, what I've removed from the collection for any reason, etc.? Do they want to know what's in our collection control files? The study was inspired by Tom Hyrie and Michelle Light's 2002 paper in American Archivist entitled Colophons and Annotations, New Directions for the Finding Aid. Here is the basic argument from them and others about why transparency matters. Terry Cook and Beth Yackel said that in appraisal and processing, objectivity is impossible. Terry Cook said, the traditional notion of the impartial archivist is no longer acceptable if it ever was, saying that it's inevitable that archivist biases will affect most of our major job functions. Beth Yackel said it even more simply. She said, archival representation processes are neither objective nor transparent. Eric Kettler, Richard Cox, and several others said that in part because we can't be objective, we at least need to be transparent. We need to document our decisions and be open to revealing how we made them. About a month ago, David Weinberger published a blog post called Transparency is the New Objectivity, in which he says that, quote, objectivity is discredited these days as anything but an aspiration, and that transparency brings us to reliability the way objectivity used to. Tom Hyrie and Michelle Light thought that being more transparent about appraisal and processing decisions may remind researchers about the archivist's very existence, saying self-consciously alerting the researcher about the subjective and mediating role of the processor in appraising, arranging, and describing a set of records. And finally, if we're more visible, then we're more relevant. Beth Yackel argued that visibility of information professionals is key, and quotes Bonnie Nardi, who said that much of the work of librarians is invisible and therefore undervalued and unacknowledged, thus threatening their existence. So how can we be more transparent, visible, and maybe even relevant? Well, Hyrie and Light suggested putting what they called a colophon in our finding aid. A colophon traditionally is defined as the inscription at the end of a book which gives its production information with the names and roles of the chief physical creators, sometimes including personal comment from the craftsman who made it. This is a colophon here from the British Library's catalog of illuminated manuscripts. They suggested that the colophon be part of the collection-level processing information. It would be a space to record what archivists know about the history and provenance of a collection, appraisal and processing decisions that they made, and even biographical information about the processor. Here's an example of what a finding aid colophon might look like. This would be for the UTSA, University of Texas at San Antonio College of Business Records. I'm not going to read all of this, don't worry. Processed and encoded by Angela McClendon Osser, University Archivist. Angela is a full-time professional employee with an MSLS and certification from the ACA. Previous processing projects have chiefly included the official archival records of the UTSA. Other processing projects have included, et cetera, et cetera. The processing of this collection revealed some materials that were determined to be unfit for long-term preservation, ephemeral financial records such as purchase vouchers and telephone bills, personnel records such as timesheets, course instructor surveys were destroyed because another office on campus keeps them, and then research reports of individual faculty members were transferred out to the special collection stacks filed separately. Well, this is transparent, but is it, you know, user-centered? Would a researcher really care about all this information? After I read Hyrie and Light's article, I thought, sure, I'm definitely going to include that in any of the finding aids I write. But then I had to wonder, can I justify spending the time on that to myself or especially to a supervisor? More importantly, would other archivists go to the trouble? Well, I thought that they might go to the trouble, but only if they had users telling them that they actually wanted that information. The users I surveyed were current UNC faculty with experience conducting primary source research. I would have loved to broaden the study to students, journalists, genealogists, other faculty at other places, etc., but my scope was limited by the amount of time I had to write the paper. Data was collected through an online survey. The survey got 28 respondents, which is a pretty low response rate, but a pretty diverse group. I certainly hadn't expected to see applied physics represented. I don't think I actually wrote to applied physics, so I'm not sure how they ended up on there. The respondents were largely proficient and experienced in archival research. 93% of them had visited at least three repositories. 85% of them rated themselves as having at least a competent understanding of archives, and 86% recorded frequent or very frequent use of archives. They had all used archives for a variety of purposes, including, you know, the typical books, articles, theses, dissertations, but also websites and work-related tasks. And they reported some experience requesting collection control files and some experience asking to speak to the processing archivist. So the processing archivist was defined as the archivist who organized or wrote the descriptions, for example, the finding aid, for a collection. And their options were yes, no, and not sure. Almost half, 46% of respondents answered yes, they had asked to speak to a processing archivist in the past. In most of these interactions, it appeared that the processing archivist was utilized in sort of a specialized reference capacity, providing details about a collection that are typically considered too specific for inclusion in a finding aid. One person stated that interacting with the processing archivist proves particularly helpful if finding aid descriptions remain too generic. Another person echoed this, noting, "I've sometimes asked archivists for help in finding information in a collection that would not come up in the finding aid. For example, I might ask the archivist if the archivist knew certain topics came up in the course of someone's correspondence, journals, writings, etc." And another respondent had pointed out some incorrect information in the finding aid. Half of the respondents had never asked to speak to the processing archivist, and one respondent said they weren't sure. I asked, in the process of doing research, have you ever requested to see any of the following materials? These would be things that you would normally find in collection control files, and they were asked to answer yes, no, and not sure to whether they'd requested each type of these records. 29% of them had requested to see records relating to the acquisition of a collection, so a curator's research into the notability of a person, or notes she took in meeting with a potential donor. 25% have requested information pertaining to materials separated from the collection for a variety of reasons, and 25% had requested to see notes regarding the original organization. It's only a quarter of the people, and it doesn't seem like much, but it was pretty amazing to me that they had requested these records at all, because I just thought that the control files really wouldn't be on researchers' radars at all. Only 32% of them had never requested any type of control file type record. Then they were given that same list of common control file, or what I called administrative records, and were asked, the following are examples of information about a collection that most archives keep apart from a collection, sometimes inaccessible to researchers. If these materials were made available to you, how interested would you be in seeing them? This chart breaks down the users' responses, their interest level in each of these types of records, from most interested on the left to least interested on the right. So what do users want to know? Well, overall, they want to know two basic things. What's missing, and why do we have what we have? They want to know about any material that's missing from a collection, materials transferred to other repositories, perhaps because of deaccessioning, discarded materials, materials returned to the donor, and materials separated from the collection to be cataloged separately, which is a pretty common practice with books. They also wanted to see documentation of our decisions to acquire a collection, our notes on the acquisition of a collection, and our appraisal criteria. What are they really not so interested in? Well, they're really not interested in prior uses of the collection, which I gauge through call slips or prior requests for copying or duplication. They're neutral about old superseded versions of finding aids. They're neutral about contacts with the donor, such as correspondence, and also about the deed of gift, don't really care. And they're also neutral about the original order and condition of a collection. This is interesting since the primary intention of the colophon is to disclose processing information. Of course, most users might not realize that we often reorganize things when we process, or of course they might just not be interested. Next, I asked, how much do our researchers want to know about us? Participants were given a list of information about the processing archivist that might be recorded in a colophon and asked to mark all the ones they'd be interested in. Do they want to know that I take large scissors to oral history transcripts, for example? Well, 86% of the respondents selected at least one type of information that they'd want to know about the archivist. 3/4 of respondents who answered the question wanted to know the name of the processing archivist. 21 of 24 people who responded wanted to know the job title of the archivist. 13 of 24 wanted to know if the processor was a full or part-time employee, an intern, or a volunteer. And the same percent, 13 of 24, wanted to know if the processor held any degrees, and if so, what type. 10 of 24 were interested in any other collections the processor had worked on. And very few people were interested in the political affiliation or gender of the processing archivist. One person seemed to detect the motive for asking that question, stating that the question, quote, seems to assume a political gender educational bias on the part of the archivist that, in my experience, I have never encountered. Of course, bias in processing probably wouldn't have been immediately obvious, if at all. Other respondents' comments on this question suggest that they made distinctions between what they might be interested in and what they feel entitled to. One respondent said, I'd like to know more about political affiliation, but believe it would violate their privacy to ask for more than what is publicly available. And that concludes my findings. As far as for future research, I'd love to see the study done with many, many more participants. I think the study would have been more effective if I'd only sent it to known users of archives. That's tricky. And I'd like to see someone study whether users even look at the administrative information section of finding aids. One respondent said that something they'd like to know is when the collection was processed. And this is something that is pretty typical to find in the administrative info section of finding aids. But you know, it's put there, I assume, for our own purposes. I had no idea that researchers had any interest in when a collection was processed. I'd like to know what they would want that information for. So this is all kind of about transparency and providing, you know, being willing to disclose this information. And so I just take a trip through what is the state of transparency in archives today. In the 2 short years since conducting this study, the means for archivists to freely increase their visibility has obviously exploded. Archivists create processing blogs and wikis. They Twitter. They sometimes use Facebook professionally. You can find me on my unprotected Twitter feed, my Facebook page, our archives website, our blog, et cetera, all over the place. So here are 3 of the many, many examples of processing blogs. A nice directory of all these blogs is actually being developed by Kate on her Archives 2.0 wiki. Up here we have A View to Hugh, which is from UNC, documenting the processing of the very large collection of photographer Hugh Morton. They have a lot of users. Ashes of Waco in the middle there at Texas State University documents the digitization and exhibition of materials related to the 1993 raid of the Branch Davidian complex in Waco. CMC Archives Processing at the bottom is the processing blog of the Computer Music Center at Columbia. It documents the processing of a wide range of AV materials and other materials. Here are some archives and archivists on Twitter. Perhaps some of you are Twittering right now. If I had a live way to show that, that'd be great. But these are some tweets from archives and archivists that's somewhat related to processing or appraisal. So we've got one up here about, you know, a cool find that someone found while processing a collection. Lisa Grimm on the right talks about, today a man will appear with a van to take us to a mystery warehouse in South Philly where we are told we have stuff to make decisions on. One on the left about deaccessioning and why, and then the Drexel Archives, which is an institutional sort of archives Twitter feed. Some archivists are using Facebook professionally to network with their users, faculty, and people interested in the projects they do. Could we possibly link our finding aids or our staff directories to our Facebook pages or to our Twitter feeds? The Chronicle of Higher Education reported on a session at this year's ACRL annual meeting called Beyond the Buzz, Planning Library Facebook Initiatives Grounded in User Needs. 2 librarians from George Washington University talked about a survey they did last year on students' use of Facebook and how the university's library could tap into that space without scaring students off. For instance, you shouldn't poke your students. That scares them. that presentation is available online at SlideShare. So part of Archives 2.0 is the willingness to take risks. So if we start including colophons in our finding aids, what are sort of the risks that we would have to deal with? First, do we risk offending donors? How do we feel about exposing the fact that, say, someone's grandma's clippings that they so carefully collected and then donated got trashed because they had no research value? What about revealing our decision to minimally process or just encode without processing? What if this were expanded to say why more detailed processing wasn't anticipated? And from a simple usability standpoint, are we cluttering up the finding aids with more text, taking away focus from the stuff more directly related to the collection? And finally, do we just risk wasting time? This could be our biggest concern. I say colophons, yes. I argue that, yes, we should try to expand on our regular processing information. I think based on the study and just my feelings in general that we should, if nothing else, include the name and the title of the processor. Most people do this, or most places, but what about taking it a step further and linking a staff member's profile on the archive's blog or website or their Twitter? Documentation of anything removed from a collection for any reason should be included on a finding aid. If you don't have time to go into why something was removed, the decisions behind that, at least record that it's missing, because researchers will have no idea otherwise, and I really do feel like they want that information. Also document if you've significantly rearranged a collection. If you processed it heavily, you probably have. Perhaps offer, even just in-house, an accession inventory or the processor's notes to researchers. And finally, document if you processed a collection minimally and what that means to you. Does it mean that you just did box-level descriptions, or does it just mean that you didn't take out all of the paper clips? And do you plan to go back and reprocess it in the future, or is it done? And finally, why bother? Who benefits from the colophon? Well, I think users, more than anyone, if you don't tell them this information, they just won't know. I suspect, though, that they do want to know, even from my small sample. I think donors benefit. It could almost be considered donor education for donors who will continue to transfer more records. For example, institutional archives, government archives are very prolific living donors. We have a few of those. It tells them sort of what we want and what we don't want. If we've documented, here's the stuff we throw away and here's why, you know, maybe that'll help them not give us that stuff in the future. I think your successors, your future archivists, you take your position in the future benefit. When I began at UTSA 2 years ago, the other new archivist and I were the only archivists there. We had to start from scratch, and I think colophons would have helped us a lot in deducing a lot of mysteries in individual collections. I think other archivists outside of your institution benefit, particularly other archivists who are in the process, for example, of implementing MPLP programs and would like to look to other repositories to see how they're doing that exactly, or new archivists who are looking for processing or appraisal guidance. The colophon can really be an educational tool. And finally, us, archivists. Most people have no idea what we do, and we've got to take steps towards making ourselves and our work more visible if we want to remain relevant. Thanks.
All right, thanks everybody for coming. This presentation outlines the results and implications of my master's research, which, as the long subtitle indicates, was a content analysis of user annotations or comments to online archival collections. First, I'm just going to give you a brief background on the project. As we know, there are many things that limit our archival description, including restraints on time and resources, our own limited knowledge and subjectivity, and descriptive methods that address our often competing desire to make more materials available faster, such as processing light or mass digitization. But at the same time, many archives are experimenting with new approaches and technologies, such as commenting and tagging. And in this effort, we're seeking to meet evolving user needs and expectations by allowing them to actively contribute with our content. And we're also seeking to attract new users, create more open, dynamic descriptive systems, and perhaps even allow users to contribute to our work of preserving and providing access to our shared cultural heritage. However, there are many concerns about implementing these new approaches and technologies. For example, what value is added for users and archivists alike through user contributions? Is this added value worth the time and resources spent on implementation and maintenance? And are we loosening our grip on descriptive authority by allowing users to contribute? And if so, is this something that we're willing to do? This study sought to inform these concerns by asking the question, what are the characteristics of user engagement in online archival collections? My hope is that by understanding how users actually engage with the 2.0 features and tools that we implement, We can better determine the value of those tools and understand how best to manage and utilize contributions from our users. So there on the screen, you can see my basic study design. I collected comments from comments that users publicly submitted to online archival collections and categorized those comments to see what types of things users are saying and how they're utilizing the comment space. These are the three online collections that I gathered comments from: the Keweenaw Digital Archives, Keweenaw Digital Archives for Michigan Tech, which is a collection of photographs that document Michigan's historic copper mining district; Beyond Brown Paper from Plymouth State University, which is also a collection of photographs. They document the history of the Brown Paper Company of Berlin, New Hampshire; and the Polar Bear Expedition Digital Collections from the Bentley Historical Library at the University of Michigan, which includes materials of various formats and other resources on a World War I American intervention to Russia. Each of these projects was launched in 2006, and I collected data from them in early 2008. The reason I examined these particular three sites was that in early 2008, they were the only online collections I could find that allowed user comments. I collected as many comments as possible from each of the three sites, coming to a total of 568. 34 of these were in French and were not coded in my analysis. Here's the breakdown of how each site was represented in the total data set. You'll note that Beyond Brown Paper accounts for nearly half of the total number of comments. This is the codebook I developed, which describes the categories used for coding the user comments. I won't spend time walking through this here, but if anyone's interested, of course, the slides will be available online later. This table shows the results of my analysis of the total set of comments collected. I should note that in my analysis, many individual comments fit into more than one category, and so each comment was counted towards as many categories as appropriate. So you'll see that the top categories were subject identification, providing further information, linking to additional resources, and so on. I also found instances of users utilizing the comment space as a venue for requesting copies, offering to donate further materials, even offering complaints about the site, but these were few. I'm going to quickly walk through a few examples of some of the top categories just to give you a sense of the things users were saying most frequently. So here's an example of the most common type of user comment: subject identification. Anecdotally, I'd venture to guess that the majority of identifications provided by users were of people, but there were also many users identifying buildings, equipment, streets, places, and other subjects, in this case a train. Since the user goes on to describe how he and his mother used to take this train, I'll say that this comment would have also been coded as a personal connection. Here's an example of a comment that provides further information about an item. So the user explains that the employee's pocket has a netted surface so that you can see that employees weren't carrying around cigarettes and matches in the paper factory. This is an example of a comment that provides further info. This is linking to further resources. So here the user is linking to a site that has additional images of the monastery that's pictured here. This is an example of a user establishing a personal connection with an item. As you might imagine, much of the user community engaging with these collections had personal or family connections to the communities that are documented by the materials. Hence the title of the study, Let Me Tell You About My Grandpa. In fact, within the total of 88 personal connection comments in the data set, the term grandfather occurs 37 times. I also wanted to include an example of a correction, if only because this was probably my favorite comment out of the whole data set. You'll see that while the figure in the image is identified as Donald Duck in the metadata, this anonymous contributor says, "I believe this is Scrooge McDuck, the rich uncle of Donald. The monocle and money bags are dead giveaways." Now here's a comparison of the results across the three sites. This chart is based on percentages calculated for each site, rather than simply the number of instances counted, since an uneven number of comments was collected from the three sites, so to provide a better relative comparison. I also only included categories here that accounted for more than 5% of the comments for at least one of the three sites. These results are interesting to me because they tell us something about how users react differently to projects that are set up somewhat differently. For example, the Keweenaw site had by far the most archivist-created description, providing metadata for 19 distinct fields for every object. This site also had the highest number of corrections among the three sites, suggesting that perhaps the more metadata is provided, the more opportunity there is for users to correct that information. Conversely, Beyond Brown Paper, which provided the most sparse metadata, had the lowest number of corrections. Another interesting finding was that the Polar Bear Expedition site had noticeably more questions than answers posted by users. This may be because the Polar Bear site has a strong archivist presence. They encourage users to interact with the archivist through commenting functions, and in fact have a user named the archivist that responds to queries and requests, which also accounts for the high number of comments they have in the answer category. The other sites, which don't have the same archivist presence, didn't attract nearly as many questions from users. To me, this finding is especially interesting because one of the concerns I came across during my research was that if we allow user comments to digital collections, it could become yet another reference venue to be monitored by public services staff, who in many cases are already stretched thin. However, these results seem to suggest that it may be possible to shape the way in which your users engaged based on the type of environment that you create. So it appears that our users are ready and willing to contribute. Now we're left to figure out how to manage and utilize those contributions. Going forward, some important considerations to keep in mind will be how to maintain clear spaces of authority through the platforms we use and interfaces we build. We must also consider whether we want user contributions to be searchable, allowing them to serve as access points for our materials. And perhaps the most extreme utilization of user-created content would be to incorporate it into our own metadata. Since the results of this study show variance in how users contribute to sites that are set up and presented differently, we should think about how we want our users to engage and present our tools in such a way to encourage that type of engagement. This is an example from an online collection from Eastern Carolina University. I wanted to show you this because while they offer a fairly standard-looking comment box, they specifically suggest that users comment or tag when they know something about the item, and they direct them elsewhere to add general questions or comments. This set of comments illustrates the concern over authority control and why it would be desirable to maintain clearly separate spaces for user contributions as opposed to archival metadata. Here, the three comments, all from anonymous users, disagree as to which church is pictured in the photograph, which could be very confusing and unhelpful for future viewers. The search system used in Beyond Brown Paper doesn't search across user comments. This means that all the identifications, contextual information, and other contributions provided as comments can't help other users discover and access materials. However, the systems used on the Keweenaw and Polar Bear collections do search across user comments. These models seem to offer more utility because they allow the comments to help users retrieve search results, including those items that have sparse or incorrect metadata. The Polar Bear site takes it a step further and returns faceted results, showing users whether the hits came from user comments or other sections of the site. This approach allows user contributions to become a part of the discovery system while very clearly differentiating between user and archivist-created description. A couple examples were found of sites incorporating user-contributed information into their own descriptive metadata, as seen here on Beyond Brown Paper. This seems to be the most involved, time-consuming, and probably also controversial way to deal with user contributions. The Polar Bear site only incorporates contributions into their description if proper documentation is provided, such as a death certificate or discharge papers. This is an example of a contribution from an anonymous user incorporated into the archival metadata on the Keweenaw site. And you can see that the contribution, which was added to the description field, is clearly and parenthetically attributed to an anonymous patron. It's my hope that these findings will help archivists become more comfortable with incorporating Archives 2.0 approaches into their own digital projects and other endeavors, and to make room for user contributions alongside their archival description. This research has left me with some unanswered questions and thoughts that should be further explored. For example, how might users respond differently to collections of other formats, such as text-based materials, rather than photographic materials, or mass-digitized collections, which have only extremely minimal metadata? I'm also curious about whether the results of this study have any implications for finding aids. Would users be as active and willing to contribute to and comment on archival finding aids? Or is there something about the item or object being immediately visible on the screen that encourages users to comment and contribute? If we wish to experiment with incorporating user contributions into archival metadata, how might we go about verifying the accuracy of those comments? Or should we merely leave the two types of contributions, archive-generated and user-generated, completely separate? Or, as a third option, should we attempt to incorporate comments but clearly attribute them to unverified sources, like in the Keweenaw example? Finally, if you're thinking about allowing user comments to your online collections, it seems worthwhile to consider how you would like your users to interact with your site and design your system and procedures accordingly. Whatever expectations you have of your users, make them explicit on your site. Invite them to share their knowledge about the materials, have discussions with one another, and share other resources. You may also invite them to make corrections, ask questions, or request copies if you're willing to develop a workflow to manage and respond to those types of requests. Whatever approaches we take, I hope we can find manageable ways to not only allow our user communities to share their knowledge, resources, and thoughts about the historical record, but to find ways to harness and make use of their contributions as well. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak at this session. My primary goal in the next 15 minutes is to provide some insight as to why and how archival repositories are embracing Web 2.0 with respect to their digital collections. You'll see from this title slide that I've included just a few examples of commercial Web 2.0 applications. So my second goal is to introduce you to how a few of these applications and homegrown Web 2.0 applications are being used by archival repositories with respect to their digital collections. So these are just some of the things that I'm going to cover with respect to Archives 2.0, proposing new services, opening to new ideas, and finding new ways of doing things to diverse kinds of people. So, as Jessica mentioned in her presentation, there's a noticeable increase in archival professionals undertaking projects to convert their physical collections of photographs, documents, and audiovisual materials to digital format and displaying these surrogates of these primary sources on their websites. They're doing so with the intent of making this information accessible from anywhere at any time to users that may not have users' collections before. So these are just some examples of repositories who are exposing their digital collections to the public. So simultaneously, the web is moving towards collective intelligence and participation. Things like blogs, wikis, podcasts, RSS feeds, and collaborative tagging are all Web 2.0 terms that are becoming more familiar to both online users and to mainstream society. And social networking sites such as YouTube, Flickr, Facebook, and Twitter are showing us environments in which users can easily contribute, not just view content. These are 2009 stats from the Pew Internet and American Life Project. Just to highlight a few of the stats, you'll see that over 70% of Gen Y are watching videos online, and nearly the same number of percentage have a profile on social network site. Also, as of December 2008, 11% of online adults say they use a service like Twitter. It's interesting to note that this activity is not just limited to the younger generation. People in their 30s and 40s are also experimenting with Web 2.0 applications. So, are we missing this Web 2.0 wave? So, a couple of years ago, I became interested in understanding to what extent Web 2.0 was or had been integrated into these digitization projects. When I began reading the literature in late 2007, the answer was not so obvious. While the professional literature suggested the importance of embracing more technology or new technology to remain vital to users in the digital era, I found that at the time there was little evidence as to what archival repositories were actually doing to fulfill this critical mission. So my research was conducted in spring of 2008, and my first goal was to determine the number of archival repositories hosting digital collections, and then taking it a step further, trying to determine which archival repositories were using Web 2.0 apps to support access, use, and interaction associated with their digital collections. The second goal was to take a subset of those archival repositories which had actually implemented Web 2.0 and conduct one-on-one interviews with those archivists or special collection staff primarily responsible for implementation. And I was really interested in addressing things like why did they implement it, challenges associated with implement, and success or failure of implementation. So my hope was to provide evidence of what archival repositories were doing to remain vital to users in the digital era. So I looked at 213 repository websites, and of those websites, 40% hosted a digital collection. And the second part of it was 45% of those employed at least one Web 2.0 application. And I have to say, I was really pleasantly surprised. I expected a much lower number, but I was really surprised that 45% were actually hosting one. So this is, again, in 2008. You'll see at the time that bookmarking was the most popular type of Web 2.0 application, followed by ratings and reviews, blogs, community sites, and podcasting. And I suspect that these percentages are going to change over time, and perhaps other Web 2.0 applications will be added to this, and probably applications that we don't even know about. So, just to kind of put things into context, 12 people responded to my request, with 8 agreeing to be interviewed. And there were a total of 10 interview questions, but for this presentation, I just wanted to highlight some of the more significant findings. So this was the impetus for including a Web 2.0 application on their repository website. And you'll see that over 50% of the respondents said they wanted to promote their collections. They really wanted to share content with not just current users, but future users that they, you know, they didn't know who these future users were, but they wanted to kind of get their stuff out there. It was interesting to note that whether the incentive was for sharing content with current patrons because they requested it, or eliciting participation from patrons with help in describing collections, or perhaps wanting to use some of the emerging web tools that their current patrons were engaged in and using, my data suggested that respondents were thinking about their patrons and users when considering the use of a Web 2.0 application. One thing I wanted to emphasize is that little planning was involved when determining which Web 2.0 app to implement. 43% of the respondents indicated that little planning was done, and in fact, they just essentially implemented it. So here are some of the pros. Over half of the respondents increased promotion for both the department and the resources held in the repository were unquestionably the most positive aspect of implementing a Web 2.0 application. Several of the participants cited that they received recognition within their institution and from their peers, not only for their efforts and success in implementing new technology, but also support and reinforcement from their peers that it was the right thing to do. Several of the respondents were optimistic about the idea of taking their content out into the web and implementing the tools that they felt that their users were using. So some of the cons, you'll see that time was probably the biggest one. 71% of the respondents said that time. And what I mean by that is it actually time taken away from doing more traditional archival duties. You know, when you're implementing it is easy, but maintaining it is a little more challenging. You know, you if you're using blogs, that means you have to do blog posts. If you're using Flickr, you have to post your photographs on Flickr, so time is of a concern. However, in talking to the respondents, they said time was a challenge, but that didn't seem to deter them to wanting to implement these types of Web 2.0 applications. They felt really positive about the implementation. So, the result of this exploratory study suggested that archival repositories are embracing Web 2.0 to promote their digital collections and to redefine their relationships with their patrons. The promotion of their digital materials was a consistent theme arising from my interviews. While there was not much conclusive evidence on whether the end users of these applications see them as being positive or negative, based on anecdotal feedback, the respondents felt that the patrons found them to be useful. And these are just some of the quotes from some of the patrons. And I try to highlight, you know, you want to project an image of currency in terms of technology to users. The future researchers expect us to be on the web. They are used to having things accessible, interactive, and multimedia. You know, one of the participants said that, you know, people aren't going to write letters anymore to the repository requesting material. They want to get on your website. They want to maybe talk to an archivist or be able to interact with the digital collections online, especially for the millennials. It's important to them. So, what are some of the key lessons that can be learned from this research and from the research that both Angela and Jessica conducted? Invest in Web 2.0, and these are my opinions, by the way. invest in Web 2.0 applications that work for you and your users. You know, if it's to get your stuff out to as many users as possible or making your repository more transparent, perhaps experimenting with the latest Web 2.0 technology will work for you. If you want something a bit more long-term, you may want to invest in an application that has proven to be more stable over time and have an active user base such as Flickr. Or perhaps if you have the staff and resources, you may want to experiment with your own Web 2.0 applications. One thing I want to emphasize is that while it's important to have a plan, I would recommend not spending a lot of time on deciding which application to use. Web 2.0, like many other technologies, is fleeting. And users easily influence what is hot and what is not. So if you spend too much time thinking about which app to implement, then that opportunity may pass. So I just wanted to end to give a few examples of some of the things that repositories are doing as far as using Web 2 applications to promote their digital collections. This is the use of Flickr. Some of the repositories. You'll notice that there's Flickr Commons, which is increasing in popularity among archival repositories, and this is kind of a one-stop shop for groups who want to display their images in kind of a common location. This one is near and dear to my heart, since this is the one I worked on. Do a little shout-out, Paduke. Let's see. These are homegrown. This is the ratings and reviews from the Naropa Poetic Audio Archives. Users can write both a review on readings, lectures, performances, seminars, panels, and workshops conducted at Naropa. And what's kind of cool is they update this on a regular basis. So, you know, you can, they'll rank, you know, how often some of these have been used. So they've really integrated the user comments and the rating and review systems for this, for their digital archives. This is from The Rensselaer Archive Special Collections, where users can add their favorite images to a book cart. And it personalizes it for you, so you can keep these items in your book cart and look at them anytime you want. This one is from the University of Albany Digital Collections, where users are encouraged to contribute what they know about the images in the digital collection. This is going to be the challenging one. This one is, hopefully it works, and if it doesn't, I apologize, but we were futzing around with this last night. This is YouTube, use of YouTube. This is from the University of North Texas, and hopefully it works. If not, I can describe it to you and sing the song. Okay, that's normal. This particular YouTube video is to promote their digital collection. It's gotten nearly 8,000 views. So, as it's loading. Hello. Okay, it's not going to work for me. So, basically what this is, oh, there it is. You'll see. Hopefully I have audio on it. Oh, I don't have the audio on this. This is also your introduction to Texas, by the way. Last thing I wanted to. Okay, last one. These are podcasts, and it's kind of interesting. When I did the research back in 2008, there really weren't a lot of podcasts that were out there that digital repositories were using, but they've really become much more prevalent in the last year or so. And these are just some of the examples of what some archival repositories are doing as far as putting their audio collections up on their websites. And that's it. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure everybody agrees that was fantastic, and I think it really shows the value of having research being done into Web 2.0. It's in my opinion, this really isn't, it's getting to be not a new thing anymore. So it is a ripe area for people to actually do this kind of research. And as some of you may know, when we're talking about transparency, I'm on Twitter, and I actually was on Twitter before my battery died on my computer, and I'd like to say that the other session that's going on right now, session number 101, which is another Web 2.0 topic, is also being videotaped for podcast, and it sounds like it's almost as fantastic as this session is. So I strongly encourage you that when these are made available, to go and look at that one too, because it sounds like it's extremely complementary to a lot of the things that were being talked about here. And yes, this is being recorded, so I will attempt to repeat your question, but just a reminder that you will be recorded. And that is fantastic. And now, does anyone want to get us started with questions? We have a lot of time, so hopefully we can have some good discussion. Yes, you. Is there a microphone floating around? Anybody from SAA? No, okay. Okay. The question was that in this person's opinion observation that many of the collections that are being made available online, it's more a case of individual objects, and so it's more of an artificial collection, whereas in many cases the real importance of archives is that as a whole collection, of being able to see the object in its context. And so by doing things like this, are we in fact losing some of the value or misleading people about the true value of archives? I'm getting a nod, so that was the question. Does anyone want to address that? I can if you don't,
well,
but go ahead.
I don't know if this will answer your question, but my brief experience with using Flickr at Duke is that we were using it primarily as a promotional tool just to promote our digital collection. So we try to make it explicit what we were trying to do on Flickr. Throughout the entire website, we provided links to the actual collections themselves. So again, it was just a marketing tool. And I think users got the idea that these were not our actual collections online.
You know?
I mean, I think it's similar to putting together like a research guide or a pathfinder to, you know, a certain subject in a collection. I think the important thing is to document where the collection comes from. And most of the Web 2.0 technologies, you know, allow you to tag and to give titles and descriptions and things like that, so that, you know, it reduces the confusion on, you know, how that interacts with the rest of your collection, I guess.
Yes, and to complete, most of what I've found is that it's really up to the archives to make sure that there's a strong connection between the information they provide on something like Flickr and to pull people back to the rest of it. And that's one of the things that people really need to do when they're making collections available in this way, is or to provide in the description more context so people understand what the position of the individual object is within this collection. But I've heard other people voice that concern before as well. You'll have to apologize, but there's a light shining in my eyes, so I'm going to have trouble seeing some of the people with their hands raised, so you might have to move up. But in the front? Right, and I believe that was more of a comment than a question, was suggesting that, yes, while the original context and the archival context is extremely important, that by freeing the objects in this way allows users to put them in other contexts, and that's a very useful thing as well, particularly in, say, educational environments also. That's something that's come up, I think, in the other session, was also this idea of freeing the objects from their context, and part of the openness that we're talking about with some of Archives 2.0, it is being willing to let go of some of what we hold in near and dear, which is that an object must be considered in its context. Again, we don't want to lose that, but by freeing things up, we allow other people to put them in their context, and that's very useful. Yes, you. Right. Again, that's a very useful comment coming from somebody who's working for a state archives, that state officials and other people are of course, using Web 2.0 applications themselves and creating records in these venues, which as the state archives, they're trying to grapple with how to deal with that. And I'm sure that's also true in colleges and universities and virtually any kind of organization. And that is definitely something that are questions as far as appraisal and preservation issues as well. Do any of you want to make a remark on that?
I mean, it's twofold, because you want to be collecting the content of the creators, and then also you want to document the actions of the institution. I mean, we were talking about, how to capture, let's say, we're creating all this content, our users are creating all this content, how is that getting captured? And I will say that at UTSA, starting in September, we're going to be using Archive-It, the service of the Internet Archive, and they are actually working out, they have guidelines right now for capturing Web 2.0 and social networking content using Archive-It, so that might be a good...
They have technical guidelines?
I think they are technical guidelines. But, yeah, that's something to consider, both the creator... I mean, as the university archivist, I'm kind of more interested in, these are records of the Archives and Special Collections Department, We certainly want to collect those, too. So that's a really good question.
I also wanted to mention we're facing the same issue at the North Carolina State Archives. Our governor has YouTube, Twitter, and a Facebook account as well. And so we're struggling with, what do we capture? It's a little more challenging with the state institution because they're considered public records. So, how do you capture it? And I guess that was part of my point of kind of the reality check slide, is that, if you're going to, sometimes you don't have any control. I mean, the governor just kind of did it, and we're like, okay, thanks. If you're going to start implementing some of these Web 2.0 apps, you really kind of have to keep in mind, what are you going to do with this stuff? Are you going to capture the user comments? Are you going to integrate them into your finding aid? So you do have to give some thought to what you're going to do with user comments or things like that.
Oh, do you want to go ahead? And we've got a question.
I just wanted to add something real quick. One thing I noticed was that NARA has a comment policy on their website for their Flickr collections, and it talks about things like what is inappropriate for users to be putting in a comment and would result in being taken down by them and how they're moderating. But another thing was, one point on their list was that all the user comments are released into the public domain, which I thought was interesting, because it makes me wonder, are the user comments then becoming part of their collections? Is it becoming one with the materials that they're putting up? And then they don't own that content because they're using the term public domain, but what are their plans for that? Or what, I'd love to learn a little bit more about what their thinking is behind that approach.
I'm not aware of any sessions on this program that have to do with issues of this kind of appraisal of Web 2.0 records. In terms of how you deal with things like that this question's bringing up, or in preservation. If anybody's aware of a session that's dealing with that, hold your hand up. Otherwise, this sounds like a really fantastic topic for next year for a session proposal, and I'd really like to see that. And we have our next question. Question is, what's being done with archives who are doing these kinds of projects regarding incorrect information that is put up by users, for example, in the comments specifically, I think, on things?
It seems that moderation in general, even at a low level, seems to be like a lot to take on for a lot of archives. So certainly something like, if the information being provided is incorrect and sort of trying to vet all of that, I haven't seen any archive that's doing that type of thing actively. Certainly removing spam or something that might be offensive, but to the level of not wanting user comments to be providing incorrect information, I think that might be a little too work intensive for most folks. I think what we need to do, and what most archives are doing, is simply relying on the clear differentiation between our authoritative description, which we could be, sometimes we're wrong too. but it's sort of like, with Wikipedia and things, I mean, users of the internet need to get used to, I think, understanding that user comments and things contributed in this sort of crowdsourced world, they need to have their own guard up. And I think that's the way things are moving. And I think that in order for this to be manageable for archives, I mean, if they want to incorporate user contributions, I think, into their own metadata, then vetting is one thing. But as far as letting it sit there and be clearly contributed by anonymous users, who knows? I think we need to put it on our other users to have their own guards up about that kind of thing.
So the follow-up question is, has anybody experienced any negative impact of having users put up comments that are then not moderated, that the comment just stays there and it's incorrect or what have you? And I've got an answer to that, but go ahead.
And this is, again, I'm just talking about my experience at Duke University, but we were actually initially concerned because UNC is our rival, that they were going to add comments to our, you know, Duke sucks or whatever. But so we kind of had to let that go and to say, you know what, this is an open environment. And I have to say, in the time that I was there, we got no negative comments. They were really positive comments. The other thing, just to reemphasize, is that on each digital collection that our set that we put, we always had a link to the finding aid and to the authoritative source. So there really was never a question. If there was an incorrect user comment, they could always go to the source and find out what the real deal was. So.
And in my experience, particularly if you've heard people from the Library of Congress talk about their experience on Flickr, depending on where you are, if you have a very engaged user community, as they've experienced on Flickr, people will correct. Again, this depends on your environment. But in many times, if there's incorrect information, the user community itself will police and self-correct. The other thing is I highly recommend for anybody who's not read it the final report of the pilot project of the LOC on Flickr. And I'm reasonably certain that question is addressed. I can't say for sure, but if you have not read it, it's a terrific document.
Can I comment on that?
One comment?
Recently, I had we have kind of a newish blog, and I do kind of a monthly feature on some aspect of UTSA's history. And so this one post I did, it's like by far our most popular one, I think, because I put a link on Wikipedia, but it's about the mascot of UTSA, which is the Roadrunner. And UTSA was only formed in 1969, and so they chose their own mascot, and it was down to the Roadrunners and the Armadillos. Okay, so anyway, I what we had was, are we out of time?
No, we're good.
Okay.
Just checking.
I'm not going to get too into this, I'm sorry. Basically, there were like three elections. One was declared void, and they're thrown out, and it was a very controversial issue, I found out. But they did elect the Roadrunner as their mascot. But anyway, on our blog, on this post, and I said, like, look, I'm basing this on this letter that I got from a faculty member, this ephemera that I found. We don't have any records of the student government assembly who was running this whole thing. So someone wrote in and said, I doubt the credibility of all of this, and I think that it was an Anglo conspiracy, that the armadillo was considered a Hispanic mascot, and that's, you know, and da-da-da. And so I felt like my role as an archivist was to say, well, I'm writing based on the sources that I have, and, you know, I welcome that feedback, and I welcome a discussion, really. You know, I mean, I would love more users to write in and say, that's what I heard, too, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, if you know more about that, and especially if you have any records pertaining to that, please give them to us, because, you know, I will happily write a follow-up on that kind of information. So, you know, I welcome the negative comments with the good ones, too. I'm just glad people are reading the blog.
The gentleman in the front. Okay, the question was directed at Jessica, and it was regarding her observation that people seem to be more apt to comment on visual items, and the person said that, you know, that's easy because you see an image and you can react very quickly. And the question is, how are we going to overcome that barrier with things like text and audio, which it takes longer for a user to grasp the content. So, Jessica?
Yeah, I think, you know, the text documents might not be as sexy as the photographs, and so are the users going to clamor and are they going to comment as much? Maybe not, but I think a lot of this really depends on what the community base is. So the collections that I looked at were not only primarily photographic, but they also sort of had these built-in communities of probably genealogists that were just sort of waiting to share the information that they had. So to me, that makes a big difference compared to if you looked at a collection that had a much broader audience or broader appeal. These were very, very focused in these communities. So I feel like if there were more text documents in those collections, I mean, if you compared the stats, which I don't have, because they haven't digitized as many, you know, or I didn't look at any digital collections of text-based documents, maybe there would be fewer comments. But I think the types of, the ways that people are engaging, I mean, there's the subject identification, which really I think is what is especially correlating to the photographic materials. But they're also sharing all kinds of general information. And, you know, I think that people would still want to comment on textual documents because there is information there for them to correct or comment on or tell you what they know about it. And I think that we would still see some of that. It's just a matter of, you know, what the community is and what the user base is, if they're there, if they care, and if they have things to say about it. I think that they will, maybe to a lesser extent than the photographs, but... We would need to promote it, make sure that they know it's there, and make sure that they know that we're welcoming their contributions.
So again, the follow-up was just that it's the burden is more on the archives to present text documents and presumably also audio in a way that would encourage that kind of feedback. And another great idea for a session topic that I would like to see next year is there are a lot of projects not necessarily being done within archives, but where people are volunteering to actually transcribe handwritten documents. Ancestry is doing one. And so when you have a community like that that's extremely interested in the context, that would be an interesting study to see as well. And I'm sorry I'm neglecting that side of the room again. If you're over there, you might have to really wave your hand. But over here?
Yes.
This is, thank you. And the reason that I'm doing a little dance up here is I use that example all the time, every time I talk about this. And which archives are you with? University of Manitoba. We will post a link to this because you have to see it. It's incredible. They have a collection. It's a family collection. It's a family collection of a family that was interested in doing seances and exploring paranormal activity. And so the photographs of like ectoplasm and incredibly fascinating stuff, if you like that sort of thing. So what they did is they had a graduate student splice them together and turn it into a YouTube video, and they've got this great sort of spooky music in the background. And so it's gotten over 90,000 hits at this point, I think. And again, this is a collection that, while interesting, never would have gotten 90,000 hits, except that they did it, they put it on YouTube, they made it extremely engaging. I think the music really helps. And what's the name of the collection so people can search?
The T.G. Hamilton Collection.
T.G. Hamilton Collection. And it's on YouTube. We'll get a link to it. But it's a perfect example of really using stuff that's got intrinsic interest and going viral almost for an archival collection. So the comment has been on the experience that they've had, the user response with over 300 comments on YouTube. And again, this is on YouTube, 300 comments on YouTube and one video response. And that they were a little surprised because many of the comments were questioning the authenticity of the photographs, thinking that they were modern, you know, Photoshopped things showing this. But also that the conversation sort of veered away into the whole question about, you know, spiritualism and whether this is actually real, which was somewhat disappointing for the archives initially because they were hoping there would be more discussion, you know, about the collections and so forth. But then, again, they just said, we have to, you know, let this go. It's out there, and this is the discussion that the users want to have. Rand?
I'm wondering, with all the excitement about these new applications,
whether there are any concerns that this is furthering the digital divide that we hear so much about. Is this going to exclude some researchers from access to information that would otherwise be available?
And again, you all probably heard that, but the question was, with all the excitement and attention that's being focused on this, is this promoting a sort of digital divide where people who do not have access to these kinds of tools are being cut out of this activity? Anybody want to do that one? I'll do it, but go ahead.
Well, hopefully this will answer, but I think this emphasizes knowing your user base. Who are you targeting or trying to target with using these Web 2.0 applications? And this is just my opinion, so don't hate me. But I think archival repositories traditionally have not done enough research to understand their user base. So I think this is something that we need to work on. To understand who our users are, how they're using our collections, and then translating that into applications that we can use to reach those users. And who knows, maybe we'll also reach users that we had no intention of using, but are reaching. But I think part of it is knowing who your users are.
Okay. And actually, let me, since that's an interesting question, does anyone actually want to participate in that conversation about disenfranchising potential users because they don't have access to these tools? So that comment is that traditionally, before the web, we were, in a way, disenfranchising people who could not travel to our collections. So that this is just, in a way, giving power to people who have access to the web. So it's a shift. Does anyone have a, Cal, your question? And that comment was, again, a follow-up on expecting our users to access our collections through essentially browsing a big, long document, a finding aid, in some ways privileges users who have a PC in their house and they're scrolling through the whole thing, whereas in some of these other Web 2.0 things where people are just sort of bouncing around from small pieces of information, that they might lend themselves to people who have handheld, getting access through things like iPhones, which is increasingly popular and accessible to people who maybe then don't have a home computer or a connection, so that this is maybe bringing users into access to our collections who haven't traditionally been. And next. I can't hear you. And that's a comment and a question about building on this. Is this an area where maybe archives should be more involved in advocating for broadband, for more people being able to have access to these kinds of internet tools? And that comment is, in a way, if we weren't doing this, we would be disenfranchising a whole generation of users because this is the way they access things. So that if we weren't doing this, we'd be losing a whole generation of users. And that was a comment, really, about thinking, a reminder that we should be thinking about Web 2.0, not necessarily in all the ways that we've just been talking about, but in packaging it with some of the things that we already do, our existing public outreach sessions like teacher workshops, and also the observation that you can capture, because a lot of schools, and particularly inner city schools, don't have the kind of internet connections as we've been talking about. If you can package it and burn it onto a DVD so that you've got a session that they can then go back and play at their convenience, that's a really good thing to do. I can't believe people are out of questions already, but we're finished. Thank you very much.